And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. What a fantastic crew we have out there tonight in the ideas room. And we don't have the lovely Olivia tonight. She's on a Batgirl mission, but she will be back next week. But tonight we have a very exciting episode for you. It's X-115, and this is the Secret Space Shock. And are we looking at a UFO threat or a deep space fake? And you probably know my answer to that question before I even start tonight, but I have some very important things to put on the record as we go into this phase of the real push around the UFO file in the public, which they're trying to rebrand as UAP, as you've all known and heard and seen on behalf of the intelligence agencies, who we well know are the least trustworthy of any members of government. And so we're not going to be taking your questions tonight. I'll try to grab some questions at the end, and we're going to do about 2 hours here getting into the real kind of hardcore aspects of the secret space program and also dimensional space and aquatics. So the whole USO aspect and exposing that on the political side. We're also going to be looking at some very interesting figures, including astronauts who served on both ends of that, some in space, and then they came here and they did the real deep sea submersion. And I'm going to bring to mind that, you know, we've had so many interesting contacts at times, people like John Keel getting calls, seemed like they're calling from a different realm, or people hearing these voices that sound kind of like disengaged electronic voices. I'm going to show you that a lot of these are the result of dimensional experiments in space or underwater, and that, in fact, part of what we're seeing in the hot zone with AUTEC and some of the experimentation that they're doing down there in the Bahamas has to do with creating an entirely different oxygen atmosphere for life and entirely different dimensional reality. And this gets us into a much deeper conversation when we talk about space travel. So we're going to get into all that tonight and some of the figures. I'm going to go through them one by one to show this very pernicious CIA influence on this UFO push, including from right over here, Avi Loeb's little astronomy lab, which, you know, I have to say that Loeb, with his Galileo projects, one of the bigger disappointments, coming off as a scientist, but really being a shill for AI technology and his whole thing about AI astronauts, and then saying, well, we're going to do it the scientific way, and then recruiting the really, really brass, hardcore Cold Warrior types like Elizondo and Mellon, who have just served this function of the deep state and have the long-term counterintelligence history, including with Elizondo over 2 decades. You know, now they're giving this guy awards at GQ Heroes. So we all know how that plays out. And it's great to have such a good crowd in here tonight. And as I say, we have Carolyn Catgoida out there running the ideas room. It's fabulous just to be here with you. So I'm going to jump into this, you know, some of the reports that we've been seeing. I want to reveal some of the characters who are behind this push. Have you ever noticed that all of a sudden you're like, Congressman so-and-so is really behind UFO disclosure all of a sudden? Or, you know, Senator Gillibrand, suddenly she is head over heels in love with the idea of extraterrestrial life and UAPs, and like, where is all that coming from? Have you ever asked yourself that in the past year or two during the COVID op? They seem to be building the second one, piggybacking on top of it. So we're going to get into that tonight. I'm going to look into the deep aspects of some of these figures, including this Congressman Gallego and his wife, who is the mayor of Phoenix. Some very unusual aspects, I can say, with some of these characters. I want to remind everyone to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter as we get started here, because that's so crucial to keep us in touch because of the incredible censorship that we've been seeing, of course, across the board and on our own platform. They've been taking down some videos that I've done with Dr. Farrell and previously with Catherine Austin Fitz, who's coming back on the program shortly. But it's interesting with Catherine because the videos that they're taking down, I notice, in relation to Catherine and with Joseph, have nothing to do with the whole COVID ops. So that struck me as strange. We know that they've offered weird explanations. One of the explanations that they offered was impersonating a historical event. Still not very clear on what they meant by that. But one thing I can say for certain is, you know, we're going into that territory where they seem to be taking down the space videos, and particularly the ones with Farrell dealt with Mars. I see that as the kind of canary in the coal mine. And of course, they haven't done very much of that on the space side with the censorship, but now they're really getting into it. So we're keeping our eye on that. The best way to get around all of it, go to darkjournalist.com, click on the newsletter, and make sure that you're signed up with us. That's a free newsletter. And we send it out about once a week to let you know what amazing guests and shows we have coming up for you, like the show tonight, X115. This is the Secret Space Shock. All right. The people behind the push for the UAP and their very pernicious connections. The UAP office, this has become the new thing, right? We want all this UFO stuff and rebrand it and all the rest. And of course, one of the kind of leading voices on this is somebody I'd never really heard of. And so I've started to investigate him. He calls himself now Gallego, Representative Ruben Gallego, who is the Democrat from Arizona in Congress. And as I said, his wife is the mayor of Phoenix. This is Gallego pushing there, as he says, for, you know, this hardcore, we need UFO truth. And, oh, it's UAP truth. Sorry, I forgot. a total lack of focus, lawmaker on a mission to compel Pentagon to take UFOs seriously. Now, the guy who's writing this article for Politico is Brian Bender, who brought us the TTSA. He was the one who was like, oh, this is confirmed. And then the New York Times could be like, oh, hey, ping, 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 ping. This guy over there at Politico, he's saying this is all confirmed, so we can just use his confirmation to run this lousy story about Lou Elizondo. And false disclosure, CIA disclosure. And that has the UFO threat attached to it. And there's a reason for that, which they've been building up now since, you know, really over 70 years. But they really feel like they have it in position now. And the whole idea is control from space on what's on the ground. So that's Bender writing. And Bender, I've pointed out before, in his articles, a big Kennedy hater, which I find interesting. And also, Bender is somebody who just stands up dramatically for TTSA, was on their TV shows, and just, you know, does cartwheels for them. And then when the heat turns up, you know, like when they're $50 million in debt and exposed as a CIA company, he waltzes over to the side and starts promoting these other people. So very strange character over there at Politico. Now, the headline of this article, there's been a growing number of reports in recent years from Navy pilots and other military personnel of highly advanced craft of unknown origin violating protected airspace. Now, they know the origin real well. They've been studying it 80 years. This didn't just pop up on the radar this year. It's ridiculous. Some of them maneuvering in ways that seem to defy known aerodynamics. You can find the same, if you read in the 1950s UFO reports, it's exactly the same thing. And they're pretending here that, oh, we don't know what this is and what's going on, but we need all this money and power in order to investigate. So, you know, what's interesting are what is going to give us the window through to who is behind this operation is to look at the people they're putting up as the front people. So that's why I found Gallego so interesting. Here's Gallego. Now, he's a Harvard grad. He went to the Iraq War, but he was trained in psychological operations and crowd control. Here he is under a different name, Ruben Marine Larina. There he is in the class of 02 in 04 over there at Harvard with his lovely girlfriend or wife there. So this gentleman transformed from Harvard after psych training, psychological operations training, and after his very unusual name change, and after becoming this, you know, very unusual crowd control specialist. Now he's the champion of UAP UFO transparency. That's right. And with his new identity, Ruben Gallego. So this guy was trained deep in the belly of the beast during the Iraq War, and he got into that psych operations crowd control. So the UAP aspect, this would be really good, because if they plan to do the UFO threat part, they need a leading voice. And there's also, you know, there's, I don't want to be cynical about this, but there's a piece of the whole making his name Gallego and sort of bringing in the Latino aspect to say that, oh, I'm, you know, vote for me if you're Latino and I'll get things done. But I think they're also, you know, on that UAP UFO front, the big push is they're trying to make it look like, oh, here's a woman and here's a Latina and, you know, all these different types of things, which should just be a natural course of business and government. But they're kind of creating these artificial versions of these characters. So Ruben Marine Larena becomes Ruben Gallego, and his new operation at 42 years old, this guy is pushing it hard. Lawmaker on a mission to compel Pentagon to take UFOs seriously. Again, Bender, who brought us TTSA and all of the disposable claims that they made, Bender was the first one out there saying these guys are the real and going on their TV shows, and now he's bringing us Gallego. That's interesting. Loeb, I'm going to get to, because I think in some ways he's the most interesting of all with his AI astronaut aspects. And this is a hard thing for us to get our heads wrapped around, but where is this guy coming from? In fact, he rose to kind of popularity or being a known name by claiming that Oumuamua, the big asteroid that was floating around out there, was an AI alien ship that was spying on Earth. And as a Harvard professor, that's a big deal. This guy was set up from the beginning, and he put out a book called Extraterrestrial, all about AI astronauts. So in his terms now, Oumuamua is this ship that came in that's AI controlled from another galaxy, and this is alien communication. And what we need to do is get our AI up to snuff to make it all happen, and so that we can communicate with this higher AI intelligence, and it, like mommy, daddy will come sit us down and say, this is what you need to do to have a good civilization and a clean environment. So his headline from his article now on The Hill, why science and religion come together when discussing extraterrestrial life. This is what they're trying to do, in fact. They're trying to take over. They're trying to make science the religion, and they've realized now that the alien aspect is crucial for them to do that, and they're trying to utilize it, and they're playing out two ops at once. One is the AI benevolent super being, supercomputer AI coming to save us, and then the other one is the threat, the bad aliens that are going to come. Loeb, of course, served 10 years in the Israeli version of the Central Intelligence Agency, and recruited a bunch of CIA people for the Galileo project. That's too bad, because he was coming in under the guise of science, but we know really very often what's hiding behind that one. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist X series. This is X series 115, the secret space shock. Now, are we looking at a UFO threat or a deep space fake? This is really the question. It becomes some kind of dynamic when we look at it to really understand where these people are coming from, where their operation is coming from, and who is behind it. We're going to find some very unusual characters here. We have Kat Goida out there running the ideas from. I'll try to grab a couple of questions at the end of the show, but we'll get into questions again next week. hardcore Q&A when Miss Olivia is back. Okay. Let's get into this a little bit. Rubio, Gillibrand, and Gallego applaud inclusion of unidentified aerial phenomena amendment in National Defense Bill. This is a crucial piece because what we're talking about is them rebranding UFOs as UAP, as we know, but also giving it the foundation so that it now has to report to Averill Haines, who we profiled a couple of shows ago. And Averill Haines is a very important character. She was known as the Drone Queen when she was the assistant CIA director to John Brennan's Drone King, famous for finding any type of legal plausibility to go and drone a citizen somewhere in some other country. When I've been looking at these people, Averill in particular has some very interesting things in her background, including being a physics, studying physics and being a physics teacher. She would eventually become a lawyer. But, you know, whenever these people get around the UFO file, they also have to have some kind of medical or physics profile. And you'll find that whether it's Elizondo or Semivan or any of these people, there's always some strange aspects when they're into the bio field. And that's the connection. We're going to show you some of these connections in the headlines. This is a New York Times headline. And boy, this picture of Haines got blacked out. It's kind of interesting. But the headline, again, is interesting. I think the headline is the steganography that we're looking for right now. Spy agencies turn to scientists for answers on COVID, UFOs, and mysterious illnesses. Watch for that combination of matching up COVID with UFOs. They're doing that in the media a lot because they've been trying to link these operations, because part of the UFO threat aspect carries with it this lockdown activity that they've been pushing so hard during the COVID operation. That's a very strange headline. And again, it's Haines is the one they're centering on. Now, Haines participated in something called UAP Day. Yes, a day to celebrate UAPs. And it had Avi Loeb, Harvard research astronomer I was just referring to, and the scientist here, who's really big on telling us that AI aliens are already visiting, and we need to get our AI up to snuff to deal with their super brain. A different kind of op, but with all the same hardcore military counterintelligence types. As I said, Mellon, of course, Chris Mellon joined that program, who was in counterintelligence and deputy director of intelligence under Bush. That's W. Bush, an Iraq War Bush. And also Lou Elizondo, who's 25 years for the CIA. So that gives us, we're starting to get a handle on where these people are coming from. Here's the main voice they've been promoting lately, and this is the part of putting a female face on the threat op, which they're doing now with Haines, and now it's Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, who originally got appointed when Hillary left to go join the Obama administration as Secretary of State and go bomb the hell out of Libya. And who can forget Hillary's great quote, "We came, we saw, he's dead." Yeah, that's really not quite a way to perform foreign policy or bomb Libya back to the Stone Age. So now it's a failed state. Oddly enough, when Gaddafi was in there, it actually functioned a lot better. And of course, Gaddafi was known to defend, but wow, very strange. One of the things I'd like to point out also is that Gaddafi, before they got rid of him, made a very strange speech at the UN about the JFK assassination and really talking up this Jack Ruby aspect, which I found absolutely fascinating. And what a strange thing for him to take a big trip on when he's speaking at the UN. But you have to remember that before they got rid of Gaddafi, one of the fascinating things that was going on was that Gaddafi had given up all ambitions, nuclear and chemical, as the Bush administration had insisted upon. And, we had all those noble people going over there, Tony Blair And, you know, he's another big bomber, another drone king. But he was going over there and shaking hands and saying, you know, we have a new great friend in Libya. And Obama had met with him. So, you know, the signal that it sent to our friends after we went in there and raided the place was, you can't trust these people when you give up your nukes and when you give up your chemical weapons. So it set a really bad precedent. Plus, Libya is a failed, ruined state a decade after. That is the direct, and I mean the direct lineage, heritage of the fact that Clinton, Hillary Clinton and Obama went in there and just went crazy trying to overthrow that regime. So there's a lot of very unusual hijinks going on there. But it was, in fact, the advent of her leaving the Senate. And remember that there was a weird thing. We have to keep this in mind when we hear JFK Jr.'s name bopped around a lot. And, you know, the news is always trying to portray that as, oh, there's this crazy op going on with JFK Jr. and they're treating it like Elvis Afterlife, you know, like JFK Jr. is going to return. So I think in those circles of kind of intelligence manipulation like Q, what they did was they pushed this idea of JFK Jr. then to pump it up as a straw man, then to say, oh, all these people who believe in alternative stuff, they all believe in this crazy idea. And this gets to one of the central cores of the thing that we do here at Dark Journalist, which is the three common rules of dark journalism. One, you've got the official story, and that is very often to protect the institutions of government. And, you know, it's the single bullet, magic bullet theory. You know, some guy in a cave with a remote control device took down the Twin Towers. All that nonsense that we know now isn't true. And then you have the secondary story, which is very often called the conspiracy theory. But that, you know, a lot of writers, a lot of researchers, a lot of professors, really deep thinkers poke holes in that official story, and people start to really think outside the box and understand the nature of the reality around them. That's a lot of what we do with dark journalism. The third piece, though, is very crucial, and we see it more often than we should, for sure, and that is the junk conspiracy. That's the thing to be rooted out the most, because it's very often conjured up by the very intelligence agencies that are promoting the official story. And the idea is, can we make the secondary story, you know, sound crazy enough that people will look at it and say, oh, you know, this is too confusing, I'm going back to that official story. And very often that's what we get. So we have to keep that in mind as we move forward on these stories, that when they try to make, you know, something like the JFK Jr. thing, like, oh, these crazy people are into JFK Jr. But remember a few things on the record for real. One, JFK Jr., JFK's son, he understood that his father had been taken out by the Central Intelligence Agency, was investigating it, also had planned to run for Senate the same year as Clinton was going to, the following year. That was 1999 when he was planning this. Come 2000, he'd died in a plane crash, and the field was wide open for this first lady to go run for Senate. And this was the big push to get her into the presidency, which the Trump forces foiled. So we've had that war going back and forth. But instead of making JFK Jr. a punchline in all this, it's very important to understand that as part of that family, he understood the forces that were, you know, around trying to create a political reality, and how the Kennedys really got in the way of that. And JFK Jr., his plane crash is indeed very, very suspicious. Anyone who's investigated it understands, first of all, that plane crashes are the second favorite tool of the intelligence agencies in terms of getting rid of people, and at times their very favorite tool. But with all the unusual aspects of that, his death should be reinvestigated. And on that front, the people who've put attention on JFK Jr. absolutely right. The kind of CIA, you know, Elvis Afterlife type thing that has happened around JFK Jr., you know, he's going to come out and come back to life and all this stuff. That's pure junk conspiracy promoted by the Central Intelligence Agency, trying to make the conspiracy researchers who they term conspiracy researchers, but they're really on that secondary dark journalism level, who are looking into that real core truth and trying to get away from that official story. They're trying to make them look foolish. And that's a core, a very important aspect. Okay. The Defense Department may be getting an office to investigate UFOs. And there she is. This is Kirsten Gillibrand, who inherited that seat, was appointed. Carolyn Kennedy actually was going to get that seat. But no, the governor appointed our friend Kirsten. And when we get into Kirsten being a real kind of lead figure around this UAP office, so she's going to be one of the lead faces on the entire UFO front. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, there's a lot of weird things about Kirsten. Those connections I just gave you are, you know, make things a little bit odd. But let's find out a couple of things here. First of all, her dad is involved with the Nexum cult. The court papers show Gillibrand's father worked for Nexum sex cult. It's a very deep connection that she has through her family directly to a large scale. You know, Keith Raniere was put in jail for 70 years for the things that they were doing with human trafficking and abuse and, you know, these sex rituals and branding people. And, you know, just unbelievable. The other piece that's interesting about this is the Bronfman connection, which we've brought in through Lewis Bloomfield. And that takes us back into the kind of Montreal fascism mafia connection, which comes right through that Bronfman piece. But there is Gillibrand's father working for the Nexum sex cult, instantly poses the idea that she herself may be some kind of candidate for blackmail. It's the last person you want running any kind of UFO office, which would require real transparency instead of being, you know, just set up for this UFO threat. All of the people around this effort are CIA influence people. And that's a very big piece, I think, when we're looking at this. And then, you know, we've talked about how funny it was when they added this other office and they gave it this ridiculous name. I have the name here. But I call it Anna because I just say it's annoying name anomaly. So I'll give it a very nice name, which is Anna, but they call it AOI MSG. Let's think about that. Airborne Object Identification and Management Synchronization Group. That's about as it's just not going to stick in your mind. And it's very interesting to me that they've done that because they intentionally wanted people to kind of back off. So we have this weird thing with the Anna group, and then we have the ASRO group, which is the thing that she's pushing. And ASRO, I'm going to read this off so we keep it straight. ASRO is Anomaly Surveillance and Resolution Office. That's the thing they want Avril Haines to run and to really push. And remember, Haines now is the national director of national intelligence. That's the top position in the intelligence field, although I can tell you the CIA director is still the top of all that. Even though Homeland Security has 250,000 employees now, it's still the CIA that runs the show, and don't forget it. Now, I want to point this out, and it's very important for us to lock in around this idea. All these people, the Congress people, Gillibrand, the senators, the Pentagon people trying to get this ANA office going, and the ASRO, give everything to Avril Haines, let her run the UFO file aspect. She just did UAP Day with Avi Loeb, and Jeff Bezos was there too, by the way. So, you know, Blue Origin with all the ex-steganography and going into space, they want to make it a billionaire's paradise, right? Forget about the pesky peasants asking questions about, hey, haven't you guys been working on UFOs for 75 years? I mean, it kind of creates a little bit of a problem. Let's think of that. All right, a little more on her Nexum ties, because I think this really shows the kind of dark corridor that we're getting into on the UFO front with this. And that's why people cheerleading, you know, and you have a lot of people on the UFO side saying, this is great. and how upset those people were when the ANA office was announced. Well, apparently the people who had lined up behind the CIA operation, which is the ASRO piece with Avril Haines and Gillibrand and Marco Rubio and all those wonderful people, those people had been promised things, you know, and they had locked in with that CIA deal. That's the Elizondo Knapp. And you know, the people who supported that stuff, Richard Dolan, who went, you know, completely off his rocker for this stuff and said anyone who was against it was mentally unstable or paranoid, you know. And that's too bad. There were a lot of UFO researchers who just flipped their lid when the TTSA came around. Instead, what happened with the TTSA is they kind of like squeezed them out like a lemon and dropped them by the wayside. And, you know, they did their own TV shows and all this stuff. And they rolled around making a lot of promises to a lot of people. And what ended up happening was the whole thing is $50 million in debt. They never built an alternative aerospace anti-gravity spaceship like they said they were going to. And everybody, you know, like Elizondo jumped ship on it. And what we have, interestingly enough, is the remains of that. And remember, the CIA set up that entire thing. And a lot of people have said, you know, who were TTSA defenders on Twitter and stuff came to me and said, the CIA wasn't involved. And I would just sit there and list the over 100 years of experience on the executive board. I'm going to do it tonight, too. I don't know. Like, nobody reads the fine details on who's on the board of the group, the To the Stars Academy, that was supposed to bring all this disclosure. I mean, people are trying to, you know, get away from them now, right? All these people are trying to start a new wave. But basically, that was a big CIA takeover of the UFO file. They tried really hard with that. And that's why we see all this money awash and TV shows and all this stuff. That's why Lou Elizondo, the counterintelligence whistleblower in the New York Times, it turns out that was a complete farce. You know, he still works for the government. How much of a whistleblower can you be if the government wants you back? I mean, think about that. And, you know, he was constantly saying, oh, I'm risking my life and my job and all that stuff, but I can't really open up about anything that's, you know, I have a non-disclosure agreement. So what are you risking if you're still under an NDA and you haven't revealed anything? You haven't risked anything. So, you know, so much of this is a kind of a fairy tale ballet, and we have to get our own minds wrapped around this. Everyone, this is the Dark Journalist Show. We're going deep tonight in X-Series 115. And this is the secret space shock. Is it a UFO threat or just a deep space fake? We have a great crowd tonight in the ideas room. And we're going to, at the end of the show, we'll take a couple of your questions. I'll just take them right off. But we have Carolyn Goida in the ideas room running the show tonight. I want to remind you to go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for our newsletter, and make sure that we have that kind of direct contact. I can tell you we've been under heavy censorship, and especially in the last month. So we'll see. You know, we're definitely hanging in there. And I have all kinds of contingency plans just in case. Of course, I broadcast right off an iPhone if I have to. So we're gonna hang in there. But the best way for us to stay in that loop is if you're on the newsletter list. And that's a free newsletter for everyone. Okay, lots of updates with this. Again, court papers show Gillibrand's father worked for Nexium Sex Cult. That's the same article. We're going to go a little deeper on it. Court documents revealed this week confirm that the father of 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful, that's right, she ran for president, UAP president, once worked as a lobbyist for a secretive sex cult, but left after the upstate group sued him, according to a report. Apparently, this guy was trying to, you know, get his billing and get all this stuff going with the Bronfmans directly. The documents backed up previous accounts that the New York Democrat's father, Doug Rutnick, worked for the Albany-based Nexium for 4 months at a rate of $25,000 per month. Rutnick was sued when he attempted to distance himself from the group. Her father, Doug Rutnick, came to work as a consultant for Nexium. He was fired, and they had to pay him $100,000. Her father's wife, her stepmother, was also a member of the Nexum cult. Doug got her into the cult. So there's plenty of room for deep blackmail on this political figure who is now heading up the UAP office. That's the kind of stuff they should have hearings on to make sure that the people who are running that are running it clean and aren't under that kind of influence. And also, how deep are those ties? They need to be investigated more. There's some good articles out about it, but if you're a real serious Congress, you wouldn't put this woman who would be an obvious, easy target because her parents and step-parents are involved in a sex cult. It's wide open, that whole entire thing. There's so much money around that cult and there's so many stories around it. I think we're just starting to learn the full extent of it. As I mentioned, the leader, Keith Raniere, is sent to prison now for 70 years. But Bronfman herself, and I have some interesting info on her that ties us all the way back to Permandex. But Bronfman herself, she's sentenced to 7 years. So it's not like, she just got ripped off or something. She was a very active participant in the whole thing. An unnamed witness described how Gillibrand once sat at a Nexum table at a Hillary Clinton fundraiser, according to Big League Politics. So and there's a quote there that, the three front VIP tables were all bought by Nexum, and she was sitting with Nancy Saltzman, referring to the former Nexum co-founder who pleaded guilty in March to racketeering. So now, of course, this isn't guilt by association. However, you have to, when you're in politics, be transparent about those things. And if your family is deep in the Nexum sex cult where everybody's being sent up the river for all the, kind of human trafficking and abuse that they were doing, obviously it's going to have an impact on you, especially if you want to run for president and now you're going to control the UFO office. What it makes it sound like is they want to blackmail the UFO office. And so they're putting somebody who's an easy target in there as the lead character. That's the kind of stuff that you would hold congressional hearings over. And it's funny, there aren't any. So you know how when somebody goes to become Secretary of State or if they become Secretary of Defense, you have all this stuff, or the Supreme Court vetting, go through your high school years and all the rest of it. With this stuff, it's just like, hey, bloop, you're in, you're appointed in, and there you go. So when it comes to the UFO issue, which is so crucial because we have these aerospace aspects taking off beyond anything the public is able to absorb, and since they haven't been sharing that information with us, then you can see we're running into all kinds of problems with this. So that's just a brief look at some of the lead characters. Of course, one quick thing on Bronfman, Claire Bronfman. She's the Seagram's heiress, and she financed Nexum. So she was the central core. But she's also known as a big political, huge on donations and power behind the scenes. Bronfman was the first sentenced in connection with the group led by Keith Raniere. But while she was part of Nexum, she used her wealth as a means of intimidation. So, we're starting to get our own minds wrapped around this control files, intimidation. They did the same thing with the UFO UAP issue because they want to use it for a large scale operation coming right up. And so these are the people who are around this, and we have to kind of open them up and identify them. And we're going to see that many of the things that we study on this show are right there active in the public right now. So it's like the 800-pound gorilla is out of the closet. And so if anything, the public news, and all this stuff, which is not, they don't seem to connect any of these dots, and that's on purpose, but they're starting to catch up with like things that we've been reporting on over the course of the last 7 years. So, this is really the period where this stuff is coming together. All right, a little more here. Rubio Gillibrand Gallego, applaud inclusion of UAP phenomena amendment. U.S. Senators Marco Rubio, Kirsten Gillibrand, Congressman Gallego, who we know that's actually not his name, applauded the inclusion of their unidentified aerial phenomena amendment in fiscal year 2022 National Defense Authorization Act. Let me tell you how this act works. That's about $800 billion for the military that isn't even fighting a war. And that goes to armaments mostly. They try to be actually very cheap with veterans benefits and things like that. They're always holding back veterans' health. But they're like, hey, you know, we've got all the new nuclear missiles. Check them out, you know, instead of just reducing all that stuff since, you know, Reagan and Gorbachev signed a treaty in 1987 to basically downsize the whole thing, not have updates every decade. But now, after all those historic achievements, they're just like, you know, let's get rid of it and sign up a new $1 trillion worth of nuclear missiles. So this NDAA, let me tell you a couple of quick things about how it works. The National Defense Authorization Act, it carries within it $800 billion, so close to $1 trillion. Now, Gillibrand and Gallego and Rubio were all able to hold it up to make sure that this thing was included. So they're basically like, you know, all those goodies that those military defense contractors get, they're not going to get it unless you give us, you know, this kind of CIA avenue into the UFO file. Now, the CIA and the aerospace companies predominantly control that file, but they want to consolidate the whole thing for the UFO threat operation. They've been working on it for a while and even done a lot of head fakes in this direction previously. The TTSA part, when they came out in 2017, this is actually kind of a key thing to bring up before I read the rest of that. And of course, Lou, you know, the counterintelligence agent CIA sent out to do this whole, I've seen UFOs and, you know, I've been harassed because of it. you know, he came out as a whistleblower, but he wasn't. And he also lied in the public arena heavily for the first year that he was out, just saying things one side or the other, saying, well, it's classified, not classified. I was involved, non-involved. I was the leader. Well, I wasn't really the leader, you know. And this is the nature of how the CIA plays it. Remember, the CIA rule for counterintelligence agents is there's no truth. So I'm sure he's very good as a counterintelligence agent, but Elizondo as a truth teller is ridiculous. But he gets the GQ Heroes Award sponsored by BMW. All right. It's my belief that the United States is in possession of exotic material. Yeah, you think? There's only been, 75, 80 years of UFO crashes. All right, so let's identify a few people in this picture. It says on the bottom, but this is the CIA remote viewing team recruiting a psychic. And in the middle, his name is Pat Price. We've done shows with Russell Targ, who kind of was really working to find out about remote viewing and was working there at SRI doing this program in relation to remote viewing, studying psychic phenomena. And the CIA came in and said, we think we can use that for foreign policy and let's get in there. And they funded all these programs. And the guy that they sent in to work with Targ was Hal Puthoff. Now, Hal Puthoff is going to open up a big piece tonight in relation to the secret space and the UFO threat manipulation. And the thing is, we can't really be quiet about some of these individuals involved anymore, because the thing that they're working on, the threat aspect that they're working on in the UAP field, is absolutely dangerous. It's, you know, the level of control that they're exercising with mandates and the things that they're doing in these countries like Australia, sending people into, you know, camps and all the rest of it. This stuff is sort of a taste of what they're going to do in relation to the larger UFO op, which people like Knapp and Dolan and all these other people have ignored, because it doesn't, you know, because they're working with the people who are promoting this, and it's not going to, you know, it's not a balanced thing. So unfortunately, in the actual UFO field, you're not getting this, which is, you know, it's a real problem, because so many of those people in the UFO field need to be warning their audience about this. And I mean the word warn and underline, you know, because it's a very major threat that the Central Intelligence Agency is using the UFO field for. that's a dangerous situation. And those people should be telling their audience, not as fear porn, but as showing them, connecting the dots, as we're doing tonight. Unfortunately, they fell asleep on the job. You know, Tom DeLonge came along with a limousine and they were riding around in it. And I had, I was talking with a lot of these people in the UFO field around 2017. And some of them were just like, I heard DeLonge has a private plane. Like, maybe we'll get a ride at his private plane. I mean, that's how, you know, pathetic a lot of this was. And unfortunately, although I like a lot of people in the UFO field, and they had done great work before, a lot of them fell for this junk. And then when I questioned it, I became persona non grata in dealing with them. So a lot of those people that I was in contact with, right out the back door. And that's too bad, but it doesn't really matter to me because fundamentally, anyone who's a good researcher, these dots that are available in relation to this are in public. You know, I mean, it's nice if you can work with dark journalism, if you can work with ex-steganography, you get a much bigger window. But even still, you know, even in the public, you can connect these dots. The information is there, it's available. So in my opinion, that UFO field let its audience down by letting them get wrapped up with this thing. And then, you know, you have the pharma take over, and then they dole out all this kind of, you know, funny UFO business and CIA whistleblowers. So they replace the people who are actually doing real work, or people who'd had real experiences or abductees, whatever it happened to be, or the John Mack type, and Professor Mack, who took the subject very seriously before he died. And they replace them with these phony CIA people. So that's the way the CIA just comes in and takes over the whole thing. And they also dominate the media aspect because they can fund it. One, and two, the CIA has gigantic control over the media. I'll tell you how that works. If you're a journalist and you work in the circles of, you know, trying to get information, what's going on in a foreign country, you know, what happens is the Central Intelligence Agency is predominantly the source. So if you want a career as a journalist, especially around foreign policy or what's going on in the world, you have to work with the Central Intelligence Agency. And if you question them or their operations, or favor a story that they're not interested in hearing about, is a UFO threat being cooked up, you're out. You might as well go find another job. So that's the power that the CIA has over the media. And so many good journalists have called that out in the past because they've come right up against it over and over again. Those people in the intelligence agencies and the growth of the intelligence agencies have, you know, bloated these unconstitutional institutions to a point where they're actually threatening the democratic republic that we have here in America. So that's just something I think that we need to kind of all get on the same page about. This picture is interesting because Putoff became the CIA branch of that psychic investigation. And what happened is that Price, the man in the middle, who was actually a sheriff, who had an incredible hit ratio when he would look at a mug book and he could pick out psychically who was guilty of a particular crime, and they would investigate and he would turn out to be right. And so the Targ told me that he was the most accurate psychic they had ever run across. But 6 months after being in the program, he says something to his Scientology. He was into Scientology, and he says something to his auditor about remote viewing a UFO program of research. And because the CIA caught that, and then very quickly Pat Price was dead. So when I talk about X-Protect on this program, there's a string of people on this level, from Morris Jessup to Frank Edwards to Pat Price, who were involved in exposing these kind of things. And the X-Protect group, which, you know, is known as a kind of lethal wing of the UFO protection, the information protection, because they don't want to share that information, although it should be publicly available. They have a series of weapons for bringing somebody down, I mean, discrediting them. And they get to, I think, a lethal level when somebody is just, you know, they have impeccable credentials and there's no way to take them down. like Jessup was. And I think that's an important story to cover. Okay, so Pat Price in the middle pays the price for participating in this psychic program by being killed for remote viewing a UFO program that the government had. But that's a young Putoff down there. And I want to point out Putoff because he's worked with the Central Intelligence Agency for over four decades along these lines of, investigating kind of consciousness psychic research, as well as other, aspects, scientific aspects for the CIA. And so when you look at that TTSA operation, who was on the board, as I pointed out, well, they had a lot of heavies on the CIA side. They had Putoff, who was, as I mentioned, had over four decades with the Central Intelligence Agency doing this. And then the other guy who they brought forward on this was such a high-level CIA person, I was shocked they identified him. And that's Jimmy Sevivan. Now, Sevivan, I'll read his bio here. He is the co-founder of TTSA, to the Stars Academy, vice president of operations. That's like the number two person in the entire company. 25 years as operations officer for the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Operations. The Directorate of Operations is the top level. So this guy, basically the creme de la creme in the CIA. He also is very interesting for a lot of reasons. He comes into this having not been identified, it didn't exist anywhere in public until 2015. So literally the guy's work was so secret that no one even knew that he existed until a few years ago. That's, that the kind of level that you're operating on. But he comes out and he also says, I'm an abductee. I've dealt with aliens. I've had my own alien encounters. So this is that weird identification. So they can send this CIA guy out and he can go and meet with like contactees like Chris Bledsoe and say, like, I spent all this time, with the Bledsoe family because I'm an abductee too. I'm just like them and I'm learning. But the truth is that these are just CIA people, and the CIA people are not known for telling the truth, because that's their job, because they're spies and they're counterintelligence agents. And what they are known for are what? Creating narratives. And that's exactly what these people have done. All over the board of the TTSA, you found CIA people. It was obvious. It's not even somebody throwing shade at them and saying, hey, I think that person is CIA related. These guys, their resume are over 100 years of experience. So that's just CIA front shell company. And that's where you got Elizondo. That's where the DeLong thing came from. It was their op. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. We are going deep tonight into the secret space shock. Is it a UFO threat or just a deep space fake? I bet you know which answer I prefer. We're going to be going even deeper here in the second hour of the program. We have Carolyn Goida running the ideas room out there, doing a great job. And I'm going to try to grab a few questions at the end of the show. We don't have Olivia tonight. We're going to have her back next week, so we can't do our normal Q&A at the end, but I'll try to grab a few because there's great conversations going on, I can already see. And I always tell Olivia, if she takes like a week where she doesn't come, you have to sort of look at the rise of fan mail. And it's like, you can't take too much time away, because your fan mail just goes through the roof and then it clogs up the Dark Journalist inbox. So a huge fan base out there for Miss Olivia. All right. Let's keep going here. A little more on Putoff and the operations around here. So here is an interesting picture. We've got Uri Geller. We've got, there's Putoff again here, right in the middle of that psychic CIA program. And as I mentioned before, Targ, who, stopped working with Putoff after the remote viewing program and didn't want to work for the CIA, but, really got into some fascinating programs and developed Wernher von Braun actually came to him to develop an ESP trading training app. And now it's an app. At the time, it was a machine. And that's available at ESPresearch.com. It's very interesting, actually. And Targ is sort of the elder statesman of the remote viewing program. The shows I've done with him are very interesting. And I think his background in the mystery schools and understanding things like theosophy and things like that really gave him an edge in dealing with these things. But he never got sucked in to the CIA part. He always, you know, he told me very openly about his suspicion that the CIA had killed Price. And it seems pretty obvious from the participation. But we have to remember, when you're dealing with the CIA, those are the types of people that you're dealing with. I'm not saying every person who's associated with it is like that, but as an organization, you know, they've just become this bloated bureaucracy, and they are an unconstitutional force that's just hanging out there. When they get into the area of the UFO file or consciousness psychic studies, those are the last people. You know, what they're doing is they're trying to tamper with the human origins story. And I pointed out on this program before that they placed agents inside of Edgar Cayce's Association for Research and Enlightenment, trying to get information about the Atlantean Hall of Records that Cayce said was buried under the Sphinx. These people are very, very interested in opening up those types of questions and those types of powers while debunking them publicly, so no one else will look into them. This is the pernicious nature of that organization, which, remember, wasn't even founded the way that traditionally you would expect. It was actually Wall Street lawyers that founded the CIA, like Alan Dulles, who was working at Sullivan and Cromwell. And so that whole edge, if we go into Professor Scott's work, the whole edge of international finance, that's where you get the CIA from. It's a representative of these different high-end wealth interests. This does not have as much of a military application. It's one of the reasons that JFK tried to turn all of that over in the National Security Action Memorandum 57 over to the Joint Chiefs and said, look, you guys do it. You can use the CIA as support. They can't do their own operations. They can't go in and, you know, overthrow our Benz in Guatemala. You know, they can't throw out the leader of Iran. Like, they have to go through the Joint Chiefs to do that. And that's the same battle that took place in that period. And the UFO file was in there too, but, you know, it's hard because the public didn't have their head wrapped around it. So we're starting to get that information now. That's why it's crucial to go back and set the record straight on that. But I think we have to keep in mind, when you're dealing with the CIA around psychic aspects, and they tried this with Uri Geller, they're trying to co-opt an area of someone's spiritual curiosity. And it's extremely dangerous with the people involved. When we get to the UFO field, it's particularly dangerous because the thing that they've been promoting is the threat. That's what you hear Elizondo talk about. And, you know, what we did on this program is we exposed it, and we exposed the threat part that everybody was promoting. And so they had to kind of quiet down. I mean, I really think that so many of the reports that we did, and with people in the ideas room, that ripple going through social media, I think that they really looked at it on their marketing research side and said, you know, the threat thing, we have to kind of, let's pretend it's science. And, you know, we'll hold the threat thing for later, and we'll actually produce kind of a false threat. And we have to remember that Wernher von Braun gave us that prediction. And he was somebody who was in a position to know, as the father of our space program, who happened to be a Nazi. So we have to wrap our heads around this aspect that we were in the period that all those people were talking about. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist program. We're here in X Series 115, going deep on the secret space shock. Let's go a little bit deeper. So we've pointed out, for example, Semivan, highest level of Central Intelligence Agency, number two man in the TTSA. so much of they used to have all these bios and videos of him on their website too. They scrapped all that, and all you get now, board members, Bing Bing, DeLong, and Jim Semivan. The articles, though, that came out around all this and that still try to promote these people, like Chris Millen, like Elizondo, they often show all that linkage that we have. And over again, you'll find that it's put off. Again, for decades, working a lot with ESP research programs in the CIA. Semivan, who, as I said, didn't even exist until 2015. That's how secret and high level his work was. Now saying he's an alien contactee. And Chris Mellon, whose cousin John Warner was on the program, telling us just how dangerous, John Warner IV, who's the son of the Senator Warner, came on the program. And I highly recommend that interview, of course. We're going to have John back on the program. But Chris Mellon there, coming forward and, promoting this whole ASRO Gillibrand aspect and really avoiding the ANA project. So this is very interesting because we're starting to see there's a push-pull in there, and the CIA has promised people a lot on the ASRO piece. Now, when we look at Mellon and we look at Elizondo and we see that they joined up with Avi Loeb over here at the Harvard office for Loeb, and, these people are around. Now, I've told that very unusual story of Elizondo showing up at my cafe about a year and a half ago. And I thought, I had to double check my eyes. I was just like, is that Elizondo sitting there? And these people just kind of swim around here. And what we can see the reasons why they were hanging out here is because they were going to join this whole thing. This thing has been operationally in motion for a while, and we have to be, aware of it, and through that awareness and transparency, push it back. Because if they think, we're not able to get this off the ground, they'll try something else. And that's fine with me. The most important thing is that, on the UFO side, on the alternative research side, that we don't fall victim to joining up and saying, oh, the CIA is giving us disclosure. Isn't this great? I'm going to get a network special or something. That's the worst case scenario. And we've seen a lot of that. So let's try and just kind of make it a rule, adopt a rule of common sense, which is when it comes to the UFO file and disclosure, you just, you don't go to the CIA for honesty and disclosure. I'm not going to go to the KKK to have a togetherness rally with the NAACP. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, I think we have to keep these types of things in mind as we go forward. And it's going to do us really well to have, an honest relationship with these things, understanding that's what those people are about. And not pretending. Unfortunately, so many of the people in the UFO field got into pretending. And I think, the fallout from that is they haven't warned the greater public. There's another aspect, which is there's a public and, members of these different people's sites and things that are aware of UFOs. But what about the people who aren't, who really never got into the subject, and their first doorway in is a counterintelligence agent who is trying to warp the human origin story? Then it's doubly so as a kind of moral imperative that someone who's studied UFOs for 20, 30 years, or a guy like Knapp, should really try to warn the general public about what those people are up to. And it's not just, Knapp or whoever, but that whole field, which I think did a good job of showing how the government had covered up things. I mean, I remember growing up and reading those things. And I think it helped to inform me about what the government was capable of. That's why it's such a weird shock to see all those people waving flags, because they have CIA disclosure. It's fascinating. What the CIA is very good at is brainwashing. So that's what we're seeing. And, we have to be very, very careful about the types of narratives, I think, that we take on. All right, a little more on that. Of course, Ingo Swann has come up a number of times on this show, a fantastic, really amazing psychic that the CIA used. But other groups used him, and there's one kind of fascinating thing that he tells where, you know, this group sets him up to do a remote viewing thing, and they tell him, hey, we're going to meet you in Times Square. And he gets there, and they're not there. And then suddenly these three homeless guys take off the weird clothes that they have, and they're revealed to be three guys who look very much alike, and they are his contacts. And they do the whole thing about, you know, putting a bag over his head and drive him off to this secret location. And what they want him to do is to remote view the moon. And, you know, the moon has been in the news a lot lately because of the whole China story and the hut. And I don't have a picture of the hut, actually, but some of those stone structures that the Chinese rover landed on the dark side of the moon and took some pictures of. Well, you know, we certainly have seen lots of people come forward and say, I worked at NASA and they made me do all this kind of, you know, paint by the numbers Photoshop to get rid of all of these anomalies, and there were structures there. Well, it's kind of interesting because when we look at the work that was done in psychic remote viewing on the moon by Ingo Swann, what he said was there were tons of ruins, and there was a large industrial activity and lots of people there on the moon working. So either, you know, there was some kind of an alien aspect to this, or this was part of the secret space program. Whatever it happened to be, his work became very explosive. And again, Targ, you know, had said about Price that he was one of the greatest, but Ingo Swann, he said, was probably the greatest. So when we get around figures like, you know, deep in the CIA soup, then we're starting to look and see, well, you know, what are they doing studying the psychic aspect? They wanted to keep up with the Russians on it. Fine. But what's the deeper aspect of them doing it? Why, you know, when we're getting into the TTSA, why were they doing consciousness studies? Why were they hiring out for Native Americans who could tell them, you know, and doing all these programs for origin stories? You know, like, what's the Native American origin story for star people and things like that? So instead of having that as just, you know, hey, there's a good research thing and we're going in, we're going to learn about the history of aliens, we're going to learn about the history of these cultures and their relationship to it, these people have a different type of agenda. The HAL put-offs have a different type of agenda. And I'm going to get into where that's coming from through a story that was related to me relating to the work of Thomas Townsend Brown. Now, I work with some very important contacts around the Brown story, including his family members. And I can tell you that there's a lot to the Thomas Townsend Brown story that opens up this subject about dimensions, aliens, time travel, and the extent of the technology that they have in relation to reverse engineered UFO technology from the UFO file, the X technology aspect. It's all in the work of Thomas Townsend Brown. Now, Putoff shows up in the Thomas Townsend Brown also. And I'll save that piece because I'll give you first the background on Brown. We did a very important episode on Brown. I think it's X series 46. It's either 46 or 42, but we get into those aspects. And I have some very odd connections around Brown. I'm going to get into those tonight. Thomas Townsend Brown, you know, he was known for creating these different scientific effects, electromagnetic, working with anti-gravity. and basically creating a saucer type technology, alternative energy, and a host of other deep programs. And he worked very closely with the cream of the deep world, scientific world, through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. There's an intelligence group that recruits him very early on in 1932 when he goes to Cuba called the Caroline Group. And they're going to come in important because the Caroline Group was definitely aware of the alien presence and the UFO file and all the rest of it. And so I think they had that influence on him. Some of the stories related to me about Brown was that when he was basically in college, that he saw an orb over a body of water while he was there with a horse at kind of a prep school, and that the orb came directly to him at full force and knocked him down and freaked his horse out. And when it did that, his entire consciousness changed. He saw that he was going to be relating these incredible things and bringing this technology to humanity. And he also saw his own future, you know, almost in a step-by-step fashion. He could see the whole thing. So this is a very kind of core foundational experience for Thomas Townsend Brown. And I think he brought it with him into everything. And he actually even developed a device that recreated that because when he made this device and he was testing it, one of his aides went in front of it and the same thing happened to him. So he had learned. But he had suggested in that orb experience that it had communicated with him, saying, this is what you're going to be doing. So it's some kind of higher intelligence that collides with Brown. And because of his work and background, of course, there was no source more credible. Now, that gets us into a weird story around Thomas Townsend Brown, Agnew Bonson Jr., who was a scientist who became a novelist, was an expert pilot, who died young, and George Adamski, who was the big, hey, you know, I've contacted Orthon, these aliens, they talk to me and they tell us that we need to not do nuclear tests and all the rest of it. Adamski is looked back at as like a, you know, a hoaxer and all the rest of it. Doesn't wash exactly because he was given access to really high-end military installations. So he could have been an op, but the idea that he was just making stories up doesn't work because of his access. And also, he seemed to have an advanced edge on what the whole saucer thing was about way before anybody else did. He was actually a teacher of theosophy in the 40s, and he got into the UFO thing in the 40s. So we have to think about that. That's, you know, he's a real pioneer on that. And there was a very strange crossover that, you know, once you got into the mystery school aspects, theosophy, anthroposophy, the Casey work, Gurdjieff's work, there was this other level once you got into the 50s that threw in kind of like mystical aliens. So this is like a Space Brothers kind of piece. This is very important because there's a tie-in there, which gets us to a place where we wonder, were they trying to tie in the mystery schools with this, or was that a natural progression where the mystery schools trying to tell us about this other reality? But Adamski, for sure, made a huge impression. And in fact, he co-authored a book with a leading theosophist all about UFOs. It's kind of his first major thing in 1952. We also have to say about Adamski that there are a number of stories that are related by people who knew him, that he would say there's going to be a sighting such and such a place, you know, 5:30 in the morning, and then they would drive there and see these craft. So something is going on far beyond hoaxing with Adamski. He could have been associated with an advanced technology group that was trying to present aliens, you know, based on the X technology and present that there were aliens here. Or he could have been dealing with some kind of off-world intelligence. Whatever it happened to be, his presence in that period is crucial. He's one of the leading voices for the whole thing. But what's not often talked about is that he had an association around T.T. Brown. That is through this character, Agnew Bahnsen. And Bahnsen was a scientist. He had a lab, and he was a millionaire, and his family had been established in North Carolina doing, you know, he really had a kind of an amazing background. And when I think about his presence in the middle of all this, dealing with Thomas Townsend Brown, and at a certain point, Thomas Townsend Brown is there and they're taking pictures and things. And here's the Adamski craft in a kind of, they call it a oil test chamber. So they've got a mini model here. And the speculation is that since Adamski was at that lab with this Agnew Bahnsen Jr. person, that Agnew basically wanted to see if Thomas Townsend Brown could reproduce this unusual UFO that Adamski was touting at the time. Now, the story gets really interesting, and, you know, because of my own conversations with people in the Brown family, and I'm not betraying any secrets by saying this, because I know that they've talked about this before, but one of the things that has been talked about is that Linda Brown, his daughter, she had very interesting experiences very young when they were in Virginia, seeing her dad meet with what appeared to be aliens, human-looking aliens, and that they appear to be in crafts like the model craft that I just showed you that Adamski was using. And there's some unusual descriptions. I was given a book, which is the author's first draft copy of Defying Gravity, the Parallel Universe of Thomas Townsend Brown. And it's by Paul Shatzkin, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of interesting things around that. Basically, I think that Linda had a story to tell, and everyone has been trying to shape her story. And because the things that she's saying are just too fantastic. And I think that's been difficult on her. And I've definitely support her in coming out with her version of exactly what happened. And, you know, author's interpretations, I think, you know, and keeping her information in a particular lane is not, I don't think that really serves the story. I think let her say exactly what happened. And she shared remarkable information in this book and to me personally, which I appreciate. So it looks very much when we go back into the story that they, these Adamski aliens are visiting with Brown, or whoever it is that are in these ships actually land in the backyard of Brown's Virginia ranch. Now, we've talked about Brown on this show and his relationship to physicist Robert Sarbarker, who gave us the background on the UFO file and who controlled it. And Sarbarker, as I pointed out, was a guy who was on the level of like an Oppenheimer or somebody, just a really well-known main scientist, was on the cover of Saturday Evening Post and things like that. But when you get into the 80s and he's sort of talking to UFO researchers about saying, well, I don't know why they didn't release all this stuff. Yeah, we had the crashed craft. Yeah, we redeveloped it. Yeah, we had the beings. You know, they were insect-like. We were trying to figure out if they were built to absorb this kind of, you know, G-force stuff. And what happens is he dies shortly after revealing all these things, but they're on the record. Sarbarker had worked very closely with Thomas Townsend Brown. So again, whenever we get around this nexus of advanced technology, the X technology, and the UFO file. There's a group that I'm referring to as X Protect who's controlling this information. But here's what Linda had to say. This is his daughter talking about this experience of seeing these ships come down. And the author tries to turn it into a dream. But when I spoke to Linda, she didn't refer to it as a dream. So Linda's in the backyard playing with Midnight, one of the plastic toy horses that she's been collecting. Since Helen gave her the first one for Christmas, she had set up a miniature corral near a woodpile. I think she's 9 years old. Linda felt something before she actually saw anything. Then out of the corner of her eye, she could see three circular flying ships, landing craft of some kind, descending slowly and silently toward the field. Her attention drifted away from her toys, and she watched as tall golden blades of wild grass swirled and then flattened in the force field that surrounded the shiny metallic vessels as they settled silently toward the ground. So she's having this deep memory of seeing these three ships. Linda dropped her playthings and ran up the stairs to the apartment, screaming for her mother and father. Her father met her at the top of the stairs. It's P.T. Brown. And then, to her terrified surprise, he started walking down the stairs toward the field where the shiny craft had landed. This is all in the backyard of their Virginia ranch. When Linda realized that her father was going into the field and was actually walking right up to those mysterious ships, she even became more frightened. Crying and pulling on his arm, she yelled, "No, don't go out there. Please don't go out there." But her father just kept on walking, turning to Linda and calmly assuring her, "It's all right. Everything will be all right." He was familiar with these people. Still hiding behind her father's coat sleeves as they returned to the field, Linda noticed something familiar about the ships, their resemblance to the illustrations Tom Williams had drawn for her father's proposal. Three figures emerged from the ships that were standing in the field, walking towards Linda and her father. Linda noticed they were all wearing metallic pale blue suit with a circular insignia. None wore any kind of helmet, which Linda found odd considering the distance they must have traveled and the manner of their conveyance. Even without any kind of headgear, she couldn't really get a fix on their facial features, but the leader of the trio appeared to have reddish hair and a beard. He looked to Linda like a Renaissance painting of Jesus. This individual stopped immediately in front of her father, who seemed oddly comfortable in the visitor's presence. Her father asked a question, something about the radio, and the visitor replied, "It can communicate instantly over many millions of miles." The next thing Linda recalls, the visitors were all upstairs at the apartment, and her father was examining a box that they were about to leave behind. The red-haired visitor explained to Linda, "All you have to do is push these buttons and anything you ever need will appear inside this box." Considerably calmer now than when the visitors first arrived, Linda studied their faces and then asked their leader why the other two appeared so pale compared to him. "They have different fluid in their system when they are traveling far from home," the red-haired visitor had explained. "When they return, the fluid will be drained to remove the radiation and then replaced with their natural blood." Obviously, it's quite an experience here. Linda looked carefully at the visitors. All she could say was, "Oh." From there, the memory fades and there are only fragments remaining. Something about joining the crew, going for a ride in the saucer ships. Something about mining ships somewhere not on this earth. She returns from the voyage, but her father goes further. Now, this is very interesting, and the way that Linda told me that is it's a memory that's back there, and it became very hard for her to get a handle on it. But what she remembers is that the ships in the backyard looked very much like the Adamski craft. Now, the box radio thing. It's about the size of an iPhone. And this thing he had for years and years after that incident. So much for it being a dream, as the author, you know, is very nervously trying to make sure that you understand it's a dream. He says dream like five times. But as she related it to me, it was no dream. Now, the box is very unusual. So what happens, fast forward to T.T. Brown dying, and he's in the hospital, and she goes to visit him. And one of the people who shows up there and seems to be pressing him, trying to get answers, is this put-off character. And what he's particularly interested in is, where's the box? So as it turns out, you know, when she shows up, put-off leaves, and then her father says, come over here for a second. And he says, see that individual? Never deal with that individual under any circumstances. I have a feeling T.T. Brown kept a lot of his very high-end, and part of the reason why so much of his work went underground. I think he thought that the same group that was working for the CIA, the kind of X-Protect group with the X technology and the UFO reverse technology, he didn't want to give them any more of the things that he had discovered, which is why so many of his discoveries are off the record. And that story is just a snapshot, I think, of how this group operates, trying to get that information, trying to get that advantage, and using these experiences. But the warning, I think, from Brown to his daughter is very significant. And I think tells us a whole lot about the crew that's out there pushing this UFO disclosure piece. And as we know, some of those very same characters are involved. So these are the people. And I think we need to take T.T. Brown's warning. Never deal with those people. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. Whew. We're getting deep into X Series 115. This is the secret space shock. And we've been going through it through the figure of Thomas Townsend Brown. We have a great crowd out there tonight, and we're going to go for about another half hour here. I know Carolyn Goida is running the ideas room. There's great people out there with great comments, and I'll take a couple of your questions at the end of the show. Of course, we don't have the lovely Olivia tonight, so we're not going to do a big, long Q&A session, but I'll do what I can. And what I want to do is I want to now move from up in space to down in the water, but still with an astronaut. And, oh, by the way, before I close that segment out, this is the book that was written by Agnew Bonson, and it's called The Stars Are Too High. And that gives us that image of Bonson there. He died very shortly, just a couple months after putting this book out. And what's interesting is the book is all about these people who create a highly advanced spaceship and then figure to themselves that we're going to impersonate aliens in order to bring peace to Earth. So the headline goes, "The appearance of a strange spaceship brings astounding results in the Pentagon and the Kremlin in this prophetic novel of the near future." And there's a very interesting character in here named Sandy Carson, who's a female astronaut. "The high brass at the Pentagon were stunned when they looked at the radar screen. It showed a strange flying object falling straight down through Earth from an altitude no man-operated aircraft had ever reached before. It disappeared below the perception line of radar, and it seemed to startle onlookers that it must have fallen or landed somewhere near the Patuxent Naval Air Base. Every inch of the area was searched, but no trace of the object could be found." And on it goes. So this advanced sort of group of scientific people put together this ship and then pretend they're aliens, and they ask the Americans and the Kremlin to get together and get rid of their nuclear weapons and things of this nature. It's very unusual when you think about the author here and his association with, on one hand, T.T. Brown, one of the most advanced scientists of the period, and then on the other hand, Adamski, who was deep into portraying his experiences with aliens. And then he puts out this book and then dies shortly afterwards in a plane crash. As I've said before, plane crashes are one of the favorites of the intelligence agencies for getting rid of people. I think it brings this whole aerospace ex-protect assassination squad into very, very, kind of crisp relief, because the Stars Are Too High book is a snapshot of somebody giving us a story, and there's a lot of truth in it. So I highly recommend this book. It's not so easy to find, but do your best to do it. And the Defying Gravity Parallel Universe of T.T. Brown, I have one of the few copies of that version, but there's another version of it that is out there and available. And I will say, again, there's information in there from Linda Brown that is very powerful, but the overlay that the author is putting on it, I can say right now, and after talking with people associated with the book, it's like when a movie gets into the hands of the wrong director or something, it takes the quality of the thing down and it tries to minimize the really powerful bits. But if you can get past that, that book is extraordinary, Defying Gravity. Okay, I wanted to point out that one of the things that Ingo Swann saw that he later drew in relation to going and seeing the moon and seeing this activity that was on the moon is that kind of cosmic X, which we do so much with the X steganography on this show, and right in the middle of Ingo Swann's artistic work is this cosmic X. Wouldn't you know? All right, so we're going to go underwater, and we're going to take a deep, deep dive underwater into a project called SEALAB, and we're going to actually hear from an astronaut in this altered state of being deep underwater, and I'm going to relate it to dimensional travel, which is what I think so much of the hot zone activity is about, because I think the heightened magnetic area of the hot zone, which may be related to what Casey was referring to down there in Bimini and down there off Cuba, which is the Atlanteans' two-eye stone. And that the presence of that there, again, tells us that the nature of the area. Well, they've done all these studies about how compasses spin backwards. And, we've looked into the work of David Zink on this. When they would get to a certain period in the hot zone, a certain place in the hot zone, boom, that compass just starts spinning. So there's anomalies there that we haven't been told about in science traditionally. And when you go into that, you're going into the Bermuda Triangle, you're going into things appearing out of nowhere. Even Columbus, when he gets around there, he's like, there seem to be all these things floating around us. They look like floating candelabras. I mean, how are you going to describe UFOs in 1492? Floating candelabras is pretty good. So something is going down there when you get into it. I've pointed out on this program that Gordon Cooper was sent up by JFK to look at the hot zone. And presumably the idea was you were to look for nuclear activity. Are they setting up something underwater in relation to nukes on the Cuban Soviet side? Well, I actually think a lot of that, and remember that he remembered so many of the sequences, and people said, that was all because he was really into Spanish shipwrecks and stuff. Now, he was seeing those, and they did a whole TV show about that. There's a diver who did a whole show about it, and the show was fascinating anyway, even though they were just talking about Spanish galleons and stuff. But it's my belief that Cooper was looking down and he knew about the ruins in the hot zone, and that the Kennedy aspect in telling him to look there in that area is because of this battle, the geopolitical battle over those very important ancient ruins in that area. And there are intelligence people on record, and we've talked about them before, who said that that is a huge geopolitical zone because everybody has some different type of interest in those ruins. So, of course, we've done a number of series on the hot zone here, and Ernest Hemingway is involved. His connection with JFK is involved. The very strange missions into Cuba to retrieve all the things that Hemingway was doing there off Cuba. Remember that Hemingway spent all this time on these scientifically equipped ships, and they said, "What are you doing?" And he was out there all the time like this. And the explanation was, oh, he was looking for German U-boats. Well, the ships didn't have any arms, so if you found a U-boat, they'd blow you out of the water. So that explanation doesn't make any sense at all. But the fact that Hemingway had a huge reading from Edgar Casey, and that he was living in Bimini, and that Casey had just identified land rising, the Poseidon Temple off the coast of Bimini, rising, that gives us a totally different understanding of what Hemingway was doing there. But when he had to leave Cuba and then he died, his widow went directly to JFK and said, "Can you get these things out of the villa? And there's a vault in the villa. Is there a way to do this?" And there's a document that came out in 2016 that goes over Kennedy's conversation with Ed Lansdale, the head of the CIA, and Robert Kennedy, the attorney general. And it's all about, should they risk an international incident to get this thing that's at Hemingway's villa? So it's on the record. I've connected those dots, but they are there. We don't have to kind of imagine it too much. So here's the question. What was it? Well, we know all of those very interesting records were shipped off. Eventually, that operation worked. Somehow, Kennedy figured it out, and they smuggled out all of Hemingway's stuff on a shrimp boat. So they were able to do it. And later, they were, you know, if you go to the JFK Library now, of course, all the Ernest Hemingway documents are there, some of the most extraordinary things, and his letters. But what is that all about? Why is the Kennedy Library the recipient of all this? Well, it has something to do with that operation and that national security letter. Now, when they went with this information that came out to all these different Kennedy historians, they said, "What's the national security incident that he's talking about here?" None of them knew anything. They said, "We don't know. It's not assassination. What could it be there, a national security incident that would take place inside of Hemingway's villa?" And they were weighing out the risks of how to do it. So that takes us into a whole different territory. And the way that I've interpreted this, and this is available in those Hot Zone episodes, is that both Ernest and his brother had a fascination for these ruins. And in fact, his brother Lester founded New Atlantis right there in the Hot Zone. And he did these TV specials about looking for Atlantis and, you know, going into the Bimini Well, which is a restorative, rejuvenating well that's supposed to be Ponce de Leon's Fountain of Youth. So when we look at these things, if we can get kind of a different eye of history and forget about what we're told about these incidents, we can put together the dots and say this: Hemingway's on Bimini, moves to Cuba. He spends all this time looking for ruins. Lester Hemingway, who founds New Atlantis, including his own stamps and all this other stuff, founds a nation. He's flying in over Cuba, and he sees, after a hurricane, an entire city underwater. Later, of course, we showed that off the western tip of Cuba in 2001, Paulina Zelitsky found that city, and then eventually her discovery was hushed up. But so much of it's on the record, it's hard to hush it up. Part of the hushing it up was putting her in a Mexican prison, by the way, which she got out of and back to Canada. But if you want to get somebody to stop talking about something, that's a pretty good way to do it. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. Whew, we're in X-Series 115 here, The Secret Space Shock. Is it a UFO threat, or is it a deep space fake? We're going to be going for another, say, half hour here, and we're going to go underwater, as I promised. Let's do a little bit of that now. We have Carolyn Goida out there, Kat Goida, running the Ideas Room. And it is a fantastic crowd out there tonight. It's great to have everyone here with us. All right. We have to find out about somebody named Scott Carpenter in order to understand this next segment. Carpenter was the second man in space. And he's one of the best known astronauts beside Gordon Cooper and John Glenn. And he's part of that whole group. So I'm going to do this in reverse order. I'm going to start at the end of his life and bring him back. At the end of his life, he starts writing these very interesting novels. This one's called The Steel Albatross, which is all about high-tech USOs, unidentified submersible objects, and the kind of underwater wars that take place. And there's a lot of echoes of the hot zone in there. And I think that Scott is telling us something in those books. As I mentioned, Scott was celebrated and really became one of the most important astronauts. And he was a favorite of President Kennedy, who really wanted to develop relationships with those astronauts that weren't just a commander-in-chief sending people off to do discoveries. He wanted to have that one-on-one relationship so they would tell him things directly and go around the military. This is a picture of JFK congratulating him for being assigned a mission to go into space. And something very strange about that picture. I don't mean to obsess about little details, but the size of the hand of this man in this picture, his hand is gigantic compared to Kennedy's. I don't understand that. And it's not an anomaly of the picture because I've seen it from different angles. But in any case, he's working in the very highest circles. And again, just like Cooper, Kennedy will send these people off to do secret errands and report back to him directly. One of the things that Kennedy has Cooper doing is looking in the hot zone, supposedly for nuclear sites, I believe for something else. Carpenter is also somebody who becomes the lead figure, and they call them aquanauts. So you got astronauts and aquanauts in this program called C-Lab, which had three different iterations. And C-Lab, I think, is fascinating for a couple of reasons, because it's the first project, it happens in Bermuda and the Bahamas, and it's the first project that's really testing long-term endurance underwater. However, T.T. Brown talks about the Caroline group doing a similar experiment in 1932. So again, you know, the way that things are done publicly and what we know about them, I think, is very interesting. So here we are in 1962, and we're doing this deep submersible with our friend Scott Carpenter. They're going under in this thing called C-Lab, which is basically the equivalent of, you know, it's kind of like when you send somebody up to the moon. In this case, they're going underwater, and it's a different environment. What I find interesting about C-Lab is I believe that they're searching just like they are in space, not just for here's the physical results of going to a physical place, but with their knowledge, I think that they're trying to figure out on a dimensional level, especially if you take into account the Philadelphia experiment and some of the things that T.T. Brown did. You're looking at something where when they get into a certain state, when they get to a certain place, they can jump dimensions. You know, we've heard all about, and even in the work of Thomas Townsend Brown really gives us those stories of the jump room. You remember those that were really popular for a little while? These people would come out and say, hey, I was part of a program where, you know, I'd go into a room and then I'd come out on the other side and I was on Mars. It's the Mars jump room. And I think, you know, some of those stories were really over the top, but there's an echo there. Somebody's heard a story and it has something to do with this. Now, one of the things that Linda Brown tells is, and that's T.T. Brown's daughter again, is that she went deep into the desert because her dad said, I want you to go to this part of the desert and I want you to, you know, head over and go into this glass elevator. And he gives her the directions and all the rest of it. And he says, have yourself a nice trip. It's California desert. She doesn't know what he's talking about, but she goes. And she goes into this glass elevator. And it takes her into a, you know, it's kind of going up like an elevator. And she's like, what is this? And she seems to remember, and again, she wasn't quite sure the nature of this, but she seems to remember that when she got off the elevator, she was in an entirely different environment on a waterfront. So the echo of that jump room idea seems to be a dimensional scientific project that they were working on at that point. And I think through things like the Philadelphia experiment, through the work of T.T. Brown, they got to. C-Lab, I believe, was part of that. And the submersible part is just the cover story for it. Now, when we get into stories, as I mentioned, like John Keel and stuff, all along the way, when Keel was a UFO researcher, and when he's doing following waves of sighting, he'll get these calls, and it seems like a really disembodied electronic voice that's telling him, hey, if you go here, and the next day you'll see, you know, more UFO stuff, or don't go over this bridge on that day because there's going to be a problem and you won't be safe, you know, giving him interesting advice and calling him when he's just checking into these hotel rooms without telling anybody where he's going to be. But what I'm getting to is the voice. And I've heard this from a number of different people. And, you know, there's a popular physicist in the UFO field, Jack Sarfati, who talks about getting a call with a similar type of disembodied voice when he's 12 years old, telling him that, you know, he's going to be working on this stuff in the future. And it's like a time travel, quite a far out, fantastic conversation. But the voice thing has been a regular piece of this. So I'm going to play for you that just recorded it right off of a video, so it's not going to be the kind of greatest sound. But what's interesting is listen to the quality. This is Carpenter talking to LBJ after, you know, it's in 64, so it's after the JFK assassination, and he's telling him, "Look, you know, you are doing an amazing job," and it's one of these pat speeches. But listen to the voice. This is not altered in any way. This is directly from the JFK library and the LBJ library. So let's tune in on a little bit of this. And that strange voice you'll hear is Carpenter talking from this bizarre remote location in the hot zone. Here we go.
Commander Carpenter on the line.
Thank you. Can I speak to Carpenter?
Scott?
Yes.
Can you hear me, operator?
Yes, we can.
Now, Scott, will you speak, please?
Yes, I will hear me, operator. Not too well, sir. Ma'am, do you think it's possible to hear our contact with the interview? I don't know.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. How do you hear that, operator?
I understand you. Yes.
No, that's right. Awesome.
Hello, operator. Yes. We can hear him. Is there something you can do for a connection?
All right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
How
now, operator?
Yes,
we can understand you. Can you, ma'am? No.
All right. Before I say anything, here's his conversation with LBJ. Again, from C-Lab, deep in the hot zone.
Yes, sir, Mr. President. Over loud and clear. How new?
Well, Scott, I'm mighty glad to hear from you. You've convinced me and all the nation that whether you're going up or down, you have the courage and the skill to do a fine job.
Well, thank you very much. There were a lot of other people who demonstrated the same kind of courage. It's a great crew out here.
So. The explanation is that he's at such a depth that they've changed the atmosphere, and so it's altered his voice from where he's speaking. But when we think about the things I've just pointed out in terms of that dimensional space and the disembodied voices, they have to adjust to the dimension that they're in, or the space that they're in, or in this case, underwater. I think that this is going to open up a piece, because the thing that's happening with Carpenter is, after having done these space missions, he's now doing the deep underwater missions, and they're happening in the Bahamas, and they're happening in Bermuda. And we're starting to get a sense that when you're in those environments, you've adjusted to the environment. So when you become, adapted to that particular dimension, you are speaking then from that disembodied space, and therefore your entire presentation changes. So many of those disembodied voices. I think with C-Lab, like, there's so many things about C-Lab to bring out, and so much of it is still classified, but the very unusual conversations in that atmosphere, that kind of helium atmosphere, I think is starting to give us a window on what's happening there. But here's another thing. Carpenter is someone who is, like I said, the second man in space. He's a direct Kennedy pick. And then he becomes the underwater man. So when we look at what's happening on the underwater side, when they get to a certain level there in the hot zone, as we know, when they map the ocean floor, many of them, as we've discovered, are under NDAs. And if they're military, they're under court-martial not to express what they see under there. So if they see a pyramid or an Isis temple while they're going down mapping the open ocean floor in Bimini, they cannot talk about it. These people on the deep sea side, yes, they have reasons to map the ocean and all the rest, but C-Lab could have been that direct attempt to go very, very deep under there and under the Bahamas aspect, trying to find that level of being able to operate under there. But here's the thing. I don't believe that they're looking just to figure out what's going on underwater. I do believe they're looking for ancient ruins. But I also believe that they're looking for a dimensional effect. And interestingly enough, there's another story that ties in Thomas Townsend Brown here, which is, you know, every month he would go off to San Antonio, every year for a month. And his family always was like, oh, he's going to San Antonio, and he's going with Robert Sarbarker, the physicist who later would reveal the UFO file and the fact that Vannevar Bush was running it. Well, what's interesting about that is the San Antonio that they were going to was not San Antonio, Texas, which they found out after he died. It was San Antonio, Cuba, and they were studying white sand. That San Antonio, Cuba, is that very western tip of Cuba, which is exactly where the underwater ruins that Polina Zelitsky found of this, what she called, remember, a metropolis. So it's not just, you know, looking at this and saying, oh, I see maybe there's a structure down there. It's a metropolis of ancient sites. So that brings us back to the Casey information about a sunken Poseidia island, which is an advanced island out there between Bimini on one side, the Florida coast, and the Yucatan Peninsula in Cuba. That whole area is the core of the hot zone. The fact that those people can't talk about what they see there, what they experience when they're in the hot zone, gives us, I think, so many pieces of what we need to investigate about why is this such a hot geopolitical area. And it does not make any sense. Even the kind of dust up that they got into, which put the world on fire and on edge in 1962 with JFK managing the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's something about the selection of that location, Cuba, for that showdown, again, bringing this into sharp contrast. And when we think about what we talked about in relation to Hemingway and what we talked about in relation to his exploring those ruins and his brother founding the New Atlantis and searching for the Bimini temples and all the rest. And the other piece to bring into this is Hemingway got a reading, yes, but his mother was so close with the Casey family that there's a letter exchange where he talks, where Hugh Lynn, Casey's son, talks about going to spend a month now with Hemingway's mother in Chicago. Well, you know, you can think about the types of friends that you have that you spend, you know, you'll go visit for a weekend or a week or whatever. The type of closeness that you need to spend a month with a family, think about that. So the Hemingways and the Caseys, very close. And everywhere around Hemingway, we have these strange pieces of the Casey story, Bimini, Cuba, and all the rest of it. And then we have Lester Hemingway with his Atlantis obsession. Obviously, there's a piece there which is crucial. And that's what we have going on underwater. When we invert that, just like we did with Scott Carpenter, who's off in space, but he's also underwater, you might remember that in part of this operation of the TTSA and Lou Elizondo, he's often saying, you know, we don't know really where those aliens are coming from. They could be coming right here from underwater. So part of their op is geared around this piece as well. So when we look at it and we get into what's happening in space and what's happening underwater, these are the two areas that we don't really understand very well. All this emphasis around space now seems to be an emphasis around physical travel through space. Oh, we're going to fly with chemical rockets to Mars. We're going to mine things with chemical rockets, with people like Dr. Joseph Farrell say is not possible. And a lot of other people do too. So what is it that's really happening? What we could be looking at is in part of the discoveries, the Thomas Townsend Brown style activity, they've learned how to jump dimensions, and that gives them the ability to go from here to there dimensionally. So they're not talking about the physical movement of something to a different place and refueling and all that nonsense. They're talking about finding a way to jump dimensions to a different place. Some of the work that we hear about in Echoes through Thomas Townsend Brown sounds like that, and it does not limit itself simply to movement from place to place, but it also seems to suggest from time to time. And when Thomas Townsend Brown was questioned by his aide about this, he said, in your lifetime, you'll see proof that this is possible. He'd already experienced it himself. Remember when he was looking over that body of water in prep school and this orb hit him, which is what we started out the story with. So when we go and we look at some of those aspects in relation to Brown, we're really seeing, I believe that we're getting this piece, that we're looking at something which is simultaneously dimensional. That's why when the CIA says, oh, we're doing consciousness studies, we're great. You know, we're going to give you a new human origin story and all the rest of it. They're trying to figure out on their side how to control that experience. And you hear so many of them talking about now in relation to the UFO subject. Oh, you know, this guy who is a 25-year top CIA guy, runs TTSA, he wants to learn all about dimensional portals. And he's talking about, you know, maybe those UFOs come through portals after all. That's giving us a real snapshot of them controlling this human origin story and really trying to control our activity in psychic space. That's something I think that we need to make sure does not fall into the hands of the intelligence agencies in terms of the experience of humanity in this period. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Whew, X Series 115. We're going deep, deep here in the secret space shock. Is it a UFO threat? Or is it a deep space fake? Well, we've seen them push the UFO threat, and now we've seen a lot of the fake that they've had out there and some of the people who are pushing it. who are, let's say, you know, sort of less than sincere on this. We are, you know, I want to remind everyone to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for a newsletter. That keeps us in touch, and it really gives us that back and forth corridor in case all the social media just decides to really get rid of us once and for all, especially after a show like this. And of course, the shows that we did with Dr. Farrell on Mars that were taken down, and we came back and did the whole version live anyway. But I think that there's something about that Mars piece that we're going to be seeing more of. So many great people in the ideas room. We're going to take your questions next time on this. But I do want to close out with a couple of interesting things that I've run across. And again, in relation to this whole piece. One thing I wanted to mention about Carpenter, by the way, is I found him involved with two things simultaneously: the Boeing X-15 high-speed research aircraft, which is the famous X-15 that Walter Dornberger built as part of the X-Plane series, which we refer to as kind of foundational for X-steganography and how they were moving these advanced projects that had the X-technology through different government agencies. But the other thing that he was involved in was on October 24th, 1959, near Nicaragua, Cuba, the transport Kleinsmith that he was on evacuated 56 American citizens that were fleeing the communist revolutionary violence under the watchful eye of the carrier, Franklin D. Roosevelt. But this is interesting because a lot of these astronauts seem to have simultaneous experience, both in the hot zone around these particular areas. Again, Cuba, such a core area for the Casey research, Bimini, another core area. And then also having that, you know, in this case, the X-15 experience, which is the manned space plane that still holds the record for speed. And think about that. That's a 60-year-old record that they had. So what kind of technology were they using there? How advanced was it in that period to still hold the record now? So there's so many things about the X technology and Dornberger and the rest that we need to really get a handle on. Now, I want to suggest something about all the X steganography that we do on this program, which is, you know, the X aspect, the steganography around it. Steganography is well known. It's been known since the time of Pythagoras and beyond. And the Greeks called it a page within a page. So when we are talking about steganography, now you see it, you know, throughout. There's all this spy activity using steganography online. And it'll be one pixel of a photograph, you know, that's in that steganography. And steganography, I think that we should understand it not as a lark or as a game system, you know, something to run around. I mean, that's fun anyway. But it is, it's something that's already out there. And so when we do X steganography, what we're doing is we're bringing the consciousness and the awareness around that. Because steganography, again, is stuff that is already available in the public eye. It's already something that's looking you right in the face. And if we can get a hint around what that steganography is telling us, then, you know, it is for those initiates into the steganography that they can read it like anybody else would read a book. But for the average public, that would be completely, you know, it would just look like something that was ordinary in space, in public space. So one of the things that I pointed out, which is when I really, really drilled down on some intelligence activities that used it, that one of the things that they used for steganography to send messages were actually missing pet photos. So when you'd see a poster going along the street and it would say, missing pet, you know, such and such, you know, maybe they'd show a picture or they just describe it, whatever it is. And that there were a number of cases where, one of the cases I was following had to do with the waterfront in San Diego, and there was a series of these posters everywhere. They were sending messages back and forth. That's the kind of thing that could drive a person crazy if you're looking around and you're like, it's all messaging. But to understand that that is there, I think, is crucial. The reason I think the X-steganography is so important in this period, and I've equated it to the Rosetta Stone, and it might sound like a big claim, but let's think about it. The Rosetta Stone was found in 1799, and it took them 20 years to interpret it. Champollion is the person who figured it out. And what happened was they found the one stone that had the Greek language, the Egyptian language that was available in that period, right around 5 AD. And the whole Ptolemy period, which is that, 500 BC, right up to when the Romans take over. And what's interesting is that when we look at it, we're looking at the message and it's giving this praise to King Ptolemy and saying, yes, we salute Ptolemy. But they noticed in the Rosetta Stone that the Greek and the Egyptian were the same. And on top was that row of hieroglyphs, which were the picture language that they could not interpret. That gave them the key to interpret the entire rest of the thing. Otherwise, Egypt was just, a bunch of buildings with pretty pictures on them and nobody knew what the history was. Well, that opened things up. This is the same type of system that I'm describing here. Steganography, when you get to, there's lots of different types of steganography. But the X-steganography seems to have real heavy-duty application when it comes to secret technology projects. And those are the things that we brought forward on the program. But it also goes back. And this is the thing I want to point out about the mystery school work. When you look at theosophy or anthroposophy, of these different types of teachings, those are public mystery schools. So they decided at a certain point, after keeping this information underground for years and years, to bring it out. So when we think about X and X steganography, I think we can get a better handle on it by thinking, okay, they kept these secrets for a number of years and they had systems for keeping those secrets. But later, when the mystery schools came out and gave this information, the same type of system of secrecy was utilized by governments and by secret organizations to move very sensitive information. I've pointed out in the case of Vannevar Bush and the UFO file, this is exactly what he did. He applied the same rules that he had been using as the head of the Masonic Temple at MIT to do the same thing. He utilized that secrecy for the UFO file. So the Masons had an incredible reputation for secrecy about their sacred rites and all the rest of it. Well, Vannevar Bush just applied all of that directly to what? To the UFO file. And that's how you got the immense wall of secrecy that went up around it. And so when we think of steganography in that fashion, it's a tool that helps them to keep the secrecy. But it's also a tool, once we crack that understanding that the X steganography is there, suddenly you may have noticed in the past couple of years, the X steganography is all over the place. Because this is a key period for them to bring out the X, but they're communicating with each other. There are so many pictures with, Musk and Bezos and all the rest of it utilizing this X steganography. And it's a direct relationship signaling, I have the advanced technology, you have the advanced technology, we know, and we're communicating with each other. So that's what it's a good way for us to kind of keep it in mind when we do the show, that this is what we're talking about. One of the things that we've pointed out in this program is about the continuity of government players and the people involved in that operation. And, I think that there's steganography in the choice of the commander of NORTHCOM that they have selected in this period. And that's General Van Herk. And Van Herk is from what? The 509th Bomb Group, which is the Roswell Bomb Group. So those were the people who found the original UFO wreckage. And now it's this guy who's in charge of the entire continent, the entire United States. And through NORTHCOM, if continuity of government is invoked. That's unusual, isn't it? Especially with this whole idea of a UFO threat. So we have to kind of think on a different level with these things. And the continuity of government program is something that we all need to get better educated on, but there's not that much information available about it because it is so secret. So through the work of people like Professor Scott and the things that we've tried to bring forward on this program, we get a better handle on it. We're able to see through those types of things so that when they talk about continuity of government or invoking emergency powers through things, you know, like the COVID operation and the things that they've been doing, well, they could very easily transfer all of that stuff to a UFO threat. And it would be, you know, as I've pointed out many times, if you thought the COVID threat was something, just wait till they get to the UFO threat. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist series X115. A couple of quick ones here. Somebody sent me this one, and I checked out the program. You might have seen some of these. It's Tino, and he goes through and he looks at a lot of the Nazi ruins. I think he has a show on the History Channel. But right on top of Hans Kammler's underground tunnels that, you know, and Kammler was famous for working on the Bell Project, hanging out on top there is this X that nobody has any explanation for. And underneath the intensive tunnel system where Kammler would ship those secret technology pieces back and forth. So the X technology and the steganography around it shows up in multiple locations, but it's always related to this advanced technology, even if they're talking about an ancient technology. That X steganography is, you know, moving along through the Book of the Dead. I mean, it goes back that far. And in many cases, it will refer to the advanced Atlantean technology that blew the place up through the Two-Eye Stone in Poseidia off Bimini in the Hot Zone. This is the thrust of what the mystery schools told us, and who told it really the most in the most thorough fashion. It was the work of Edgar Cayce. So, you know, very often you can see the references to Atlantis in Theosophy and the deep, you know, information on cosmologically how humanity came in. You know, we had a different type of physical form in the period through Anthroposophy and the Rudolf Steiner work. But when you get to Cayce's work, he's going directly and showing you this is how the Atlantean civilization built itself up. Here's how the advanced technology destroyed it. Here's where they dispersed afterwards. It's such a thorough piece that I think that there's a reason the mystery schools changed the language to be that much more specific by the time they got to Edgar Cayce. So that's something for us to keep in mind as we do this research. I have a few more here. I want to say this. this is a good flashback for us. But when I want to show you just how sensitive this continuity of government issue is. When I brought up the continuity of government piece that they were trying to say in Newsweek now, they had this guy, William Arkin, who's really one of the experts on continuity of government. And Professor Scott will tell me, you know, well, this guy knows a great deal about it, but his research goes nowhere because he won't ever mention the implications of continuity of government. So the COG program, it turned out he was using this whistleblower saying, oh, you know, Trump's going to invoke COG. This is right at that period where Trump was leaving office. And what was interesting to me was it seemed just the opposite, that COG had been invoked at the end of the Trump administration, and that they had tried to do this during this period when Trump supposedly had COVID. It was a very unusual period. And one of the things that happened there is that Trump came out and gave a speech, and Joseph Farrell noticed that the whole thing seemed to be rocking like he was on a boat, as if he had resisted a coup attempt just before the election actually was thrown. So Arkin, who is one of the top people at Newsweek and certainly one of the top authorities on COG, but in a limited way, whereas Professor Scott will give you the much deeper information. I pointed out that Newsweek had blocked me because I had identified one of the sources for his article who was saying, oh, Trump is invoking continuity of government, which I told you I thought it was exactly the opposite. And so Newsweek blocked me, and I tweeted that Newsweek is getting nervous at my ID of anonymous quoted source as retired COG Northcom commander Terrence O'Shaughnessy, who was the one that was just in there before Van Herk took over. And Arkin reached down to the X series from his lofty perch there at Newsweek, and he wrote, "You are a fool, Captain Kangaroo. It's more like your speed." Some of you might remember that one, but it's worth keeping in mind just how much fear they have of revealing those pieces about the continuity of government program, that they would reach in, first of all, block the Dark Journalist channel on Twitter, and then to go in there and say, to take their top guy on the subject and have him say directly to me, "You're a fool, you're Captain Kangaroo." What does that tell you about the continuity of government program and the plans that they have? And remember that continuity of government, like the UFO file, is incredibly shrouded in mystery. You know, this thing was built up and it was created during the Eisenhower administration to survive a nuclear war. And it was taken over by Bush and Oliver North and all these other people to respond and take control and, you know, null and void the Constitution under any emergency, not just a nuclear emergency. They changed that language in the mid-80s when they were playing around with Rex 84 and other programs to round up citizens. Hello, Australia. I know you're being put into internment camps. You know, when does the level of the international crisis come before the UN saying, what the hell is going on in Australia? Well, that could be a preview if we don't get our head straight about continuity of government and the powers that they think that they can seize, and they will, by calling something an emergency. And the best emergency that they have going on, you know, they have this thing going on, this will take them to a certain level, but the thing that they really have is the UFO threat. That's the thing that they've been pushing. That's why you see Gillibrand out there. That's why you see Galileo out there. That's why Rubio's out there. These are the people. They're pushing forward. They're creating new offices. Every time you open up your web browser, there's a new UFO office story, right? ANA and ASRO and all the rest. So that's the one, in my opinion, that they've been building. And they've been building it for years. And don't think that they're not going to exercise it. Therefore, people's education in relation to the continuity of government program and the secrecy around the UFO file, along with the legitimate secret space program research that has been brought forward that we've done, you know, not the Gaia freak show and the attempts to plagiarize that information, but the real core piece of it, which comes through the work of people like Joseph Farrell. That's going to be the kind of information and the kind of knowledge that will really bring us to a different place going forward. So we have to really keep that in mind as we go forward. The combination of continuity of government, COG, with the secrecy around the UFO file. How does it work? The UFO threat thing gives them the ability to call out the ultimate emergency. And those emergency powers, they create regional governors, we know that, and the COG Northcom commander, Van Herk, takes over the United States. That's the state that we're living under right now. So, I mean, that is literally all they have to do is call the emergency. And here's the other interesting piece of this that Professor Scott points out so well. When you, that National Defense Authorization Act for 2022 that's coming up, the one that they just signed, they're giving $800 billion. And they included this UAP research office, as I pointed out. Well, in there, every president has signed a clause that says the emergency powers of 9/11 are continued. So we are under a September 11th terrorist emergency that suspends the Constitution every time someone signs that bill. And if you don't sign that bill, you don't get the $800 billion. So every president since Bush, Obama, even Trump, this guy, Stepford Biden, they all sign it. And that reiterates each time that we're under this emergency situation, that allows for NORTHCOM to take over America. Remember, NORTHCOM had nothing to do before. They weren't police powers. And they had SOUTHCOM, which is something that we looked over South America on the drug trade and all the rest of it. But NORTHCOM, the idea that we would have an actual military command that was stationed to sort of take over the United States in the state of emergency, we have to get our heads wrapped around this, that what emergency are they going to use to try to exercise that power? Who are the continuity of government people? Well, I've identified Van Herk. What do we know about his background? We know that he was part of the 509th. I went into O'Shaughnessy's background previously. There's a whole group around continuity of government. And now we've had people talk, you know, like Nancy Pelosi saying, well, I had a conversation with continuity of government this afternoon. They briefed me. Now it's okay to talk about continuity of government before, you know, you'd get thrown out of Congress for bringing it up. So what's going on with it? This is a piece that they want to bring in. And it's one of the reasons why Newsweek had the freak out that they did. When we see those things, we have to take stock and say, what is it that we know about the UFO file? What is it we know about continuity of government through the work of people like Professor Scott? And how can we create that foundation of knowledge so we're ready and can defuse that attempt on behalf of the government to completely take over the constitutional government of the United States under the guise of protecting us from an emergency, a UFO threat in this case? All that stuff with Avi Loeb, all that junk with Elizondo, CIA spending $10 million, $50 million on, you know, the CIA spending that money on the TTSA. That whole piece, you know, is so transparent now that we've been through it. We have experience. So we're giving out that information, and we're all, you know, you and I in the ideas room, we're all getting our consciousness raised. You know, we're aware, our awareness is growing around this. Unfortunately, what's happening in these different areas, even, you know, of course, in the mainstream, they're just trying to program everybody. But in the alternative side, what's so disturbing, I think, is the UFO field, because those people who are at the top of that, like Pope and Knapp and all the rest of those people, Leslie Kane, whose uncle is Thomas Kane, who was the head of the 9/11 Commission, not exactly a transparent family there, and who was the 10-year live-in partner of Bud Hopkins, who did all the abduction research. Why doesn't everyone ever mention him? This stuff and those writers and those researchers are taking, you know, the book contracts and the TV shows and all the rest of it, but they are not warning their readers and their viewers, the people who listen to their output, they're not warning them about the UFO threat that's being built. That has to change. And the more that they try to silence, you know, this type of work, and especially in the mainstream, they do it. But on the alternative side, there's also a fair amount of that saying, oh, you know, that's fear mongering. The CIA would never do that. That has to be turned around. The louder, the more intense that that secrecy and that silence is pushed on us, the louder our response needs to be. And that includes talking about it and bringing it into the open. And we're going to be talking about this and we're going to be bringing it loud and clear. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. Deep here in X Series 115, we have shown that the secret space threat has been really pushed very hard, and that there is an actual threat, and it has nothing to do with aliens, but it has to do with our own intelligence agencies creating a narrative and concocting a future where they pull emergency powers and the continuity of government. To close this evening, I know we have Carolyn Goida out there running the ideas room. And I'm going to do some shout outs and get some questions here. I want to mention before I go the strange case of Utant, who was the head of the UN, and his strange relationship with James McDonald, who was an intense UFO researcher from the 1960s, and who sadly committed suicide. And if you want to believe that, McDonald's thought the best way to do this is to go directly to Utant and talk to him about the UFO piece. And what he found out, to his surprise, is that Utant had spoken to a Wall Street Journal reporter named Drew Pearson and said to him, there are two big issues that the UN needs to deal with. Top priority, 1967, the Vietnam War and UFOs. Utant said that. He was the head of the UN. And he said it openly to a reporter. This is Utant meeting with President Kennedy in 1963 after the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, who went down in a plane crash. And Dag, who was the head of the UN, his case has been reopened, the plane crash from the early 1960s. And he went down in the Congo, and he really opposed the things that the CIA were doing there. So James McDonald, he made a few observations here. This is what he submitted June 7th, 1967. Regardless of what ultimate explanation is found for the UFO phenomena, the present scientific neglect and ridicule must be replaced by scientific concern and intensive study. My recommendation to the Outer Space Affairs Group is that it seek all possible means of securing worldwide attention to this problem. The first needs to be for erasing the ridicule that is quite clearly suppressing open reporting of sightings of unconventional objects in the air and on the ground. Secondly, the existence of an already available sensing system in the form of radar facilities must be recognized as exceedingly fortunate. At present, most radar sightings of UFOs are not getting into scientific hands. Disturbance of internal combustion engines coincident with close passage of disc-like or cylindrical unconventional objects is on record in at least several hundred instances. Often the disturbances are accompanied by broad spectrum electromagnetic noise picked up on the radio waves. In many instances, compasses, both on ships and in aircraft, have been disturbed. Magnetometers and even watches have been affected. All these reports point to some kind of electromagnetic noise, electromagnetic side effects that offer promise for design of new sensing devices, which will only be developed when competent engineers and physicists take seriously the rapidly growing body of reports of close-range, low-altitude studies. So he's giving them a very solid place to start from. And Utant, after this comment to Drew Pearson, he gets these letters directly from McDonald after McDonald addresses the Outer Space Affairs Group. Well, what happens is a big pushback happens on Utant, and they say, oh, you don't take these Paris peace talks seriously in relation to Vietnam. You're talking about UFOs. You're making the UN a joke and all the rest of it. And Utant, who's a hardcore UFO believer, as we've discovered, who made the comment to Drew Pearson that James McDonald cites, and Drew Pearson talks about it and says, you know, he said that the two most important issues were Vietnam and the UFO file. And he said the UFO file, in fact, is far more important than Vietnam because it affects the entire world. So this is the state of open conversation about the UFO file in 1967. And then that got shut down. And they made Utant issue a statement saying, you know, the Vietnam issue is the most important pressing problem, and any reports to the contrary, you know, are not true. I totally believe that Vietnam is the main thing. And then Utant never makes another public statement about UFOs ever again. But he did in 1967. So when they try to come out and say, hey, we have a UAP office, hey, you know, the government needs to really look at the stuff. They've been looking. That was 53 years ago, 54 years ago. They've been looking. They've been watching. They've been redeveloping. They've already been doing this stuff. And in the hands of the defense contractors, like Lockheed Martin, like Boeing, and, you know, McDonnell Douglas and the rest, they are deep in a program of creating this infrastructure from space to control whatever is on the ground. And I think, as I pointed out tonight, they're also using that dimensional knowledge as well. So they're on such a different level. And the level of society that we're on is so schizophrenic because of the level they're operating on and the public level, which is, you know, completely being attacked by so many different directions by what appears to be a kind of invisible enemy. We can't exactly see what it is or where it's coming from. So what we have is this incredible push now, you know, as we're under these big pressing emergencies in different countries that they're using to lock down people in highly undemocratic fashion and outright fascist attempts in places like Australia. When we get into this deeper aspect of why they're pushing the UFO piece now, and when we look back to the work of McDonald and what Utant said, they understood the level of importance that this had in that era. So 50 years later, they certainly understand it. So we're not buying the suddenly, oh, this is important. So as we started out with Galileo and his whole background in psychological operations and crowd control in the jungle warfare, he's a very good person for them to select on the UFO front if they want to create a PSYOP. Elizondo, of course, a counterintelligence agent who was used to deceiving the enemy, in this case, the American people are the enemy, from the position of X-Protect. So this is what we're looking at, and I think the sooner we get our heads wrapped around it and how much information sharing that we do among ourselves and the independent media and with the help of like the ideas from the people who are there, this conversation is exactly the thing that they do not want to happen. So we can't afford to have that kind of, you know, like the kind of atmosphere that exists in the UFO research world is totally useless because it doesn't help us. What is helpful actually is the people who understand the deep state side and understand government assassination programs and things like that. That can help us understand the UFO piece. So if we can combine that continuity of government research stance, the deep state research, with the UFO file, then we'll be going somewhere. A lot of those UFO researchers don't want to get into it. They're like, oh, you're paranoid. you know, and as I've pointed out, the people on the deep state side, they don't want to deal with the UFO crazy. Well, I've got bad news for both of you, which is both sides need to come to the table. And, you know, the deep state researchers have a much better research ethic, and the UFO field needs to catch on to that. And the bozo aspect of the UFO thing, the people kissing up to Elizondo and, you know, GQ Heroes of the Year and like the UFO field promoting that, that needs to turn around and become really solid researchers. And, you know, the TTSA fanboy thing is already worn off because all the lies are exposed on them. But the remnants of the operation, Christopher Mellon over here talking to Avi Loeb, Luis Elizondo over here talking to Avi Loeb, Avi Loeb talking to Avril Haines, the DNI saying, oh, these UAPs, you know, they could be AI astronauts. And Lou saying, no, it's a threat, you know. So that's what they're doing. They're building a false conversation about the UFO file. And the likes of the UFO research community can't allow that to happen. So on the independent research side, that's the thing. That's where we're calling out the CIA infiltration of the entire field. Not in a way that, you know, is looking for CIA agents under every bush, but they are, in fact, thoroughly honeycombed throughout the independent research worlds. They've taken over the mainstream media, of course. So that's my solution on that, which is the fundamental premise, which is that there's UFO file research, and then there's this kind of circus that the CIA is running, and there's a bifurcation now that's taking place. And so we're going into the UFO file research, and there's a lot there. And this is exactly the information that we're going to need going forward. And with that, we're going to wrap up tonight's program. It's been great to have everyone here, and thank you for being in the Ideas Room. Whew, it's a great crowd, a huge crowd tonight. I'll do a few shout outs here. Nutter Butter, I like that. It's a great name. Space Ghost, Scarlet Fire, Golden Girl, Hedy Lamarr, that's a good one. Professor Hugh Axton, thank you. Appreciate you being here. Roosevelt, thank you, sir. It's great to see you out there. DJ Merch t-shirt. Oh, boy. Maybe a fedora. I've been thinking about a fedora. Fantastic show. Thank you. Really appreciate that. Don Newway, I think I know who that is. Esoteric Gold. Think. I agree. Think. Hey, Stepford Biden is going to be on Jimmy Kimmel. Don't you think that's going to be a really good interview? Carolyn Rose, thank you. The top info in one place. Thank you. I appreciate that. Another great show. Jimmy Kennemer, Bethany Green, great show, DJ. Thank you. Wow, I appreciate it. Karen Carpenter, Elemental Footprints. Steampunk outfit for DJ. I have to think about that one. That could be cool. Actually, I can think of a few really good examples. I'll figure out something. We need an Obama Hope style poster with TJ's hair. Okay, Lou Weed, be cool. Lou Weed, I like that. Almost 1,000 likes. Satellite of Love, huh? Please don't let us wait a week. Interesting. Well, we'll do reports as they come up for sure. At least we're doing a show once a week. Did well without Olivia. Right. Yeah. Well, without Miss Olivia, it's hard. Let me tell you. You always bring your best. Mary Lisner. Thank you. B. Pinkerton. Ron Frey. T. Oliver. Wow. What a great crew out there tonight. Thank you for your super chats also. If I had them here in front of me, I'd shout them out direct. But thank you for all of that. UFO threat feels like a hamster wheel. Boy, is that true. Unbelievable. I think you nailed it on that. Olivia's awesome. Yes, absolutely. Send more ambulances. Everyone's got a sense of humor out there tonight. I like it. I want a DJ t-shirt that says, interesting, Andy Jones. Nicely done. That's pretty good. It's either fascinating or interesting, but I guess Spock already has fascinating. Najat, it's great to see you out there. Whew. Picture a DJ in a tight silver jumpsuit. See, it gets strained. The later we go on, the stranger the comments get. I like it. Carl Jung. Excellent. No question. That's great. Esoteric Gold. Wow. It's great to see everyone out there. I'm going to try this. For the first time in history, I'm going to highlight a comment. Let's see here. Michael Snow. It's great to see you, sir. Lou Weed. Going deep shot glasses. Oh. Yeah, but I don't drink those. Kind of useless. Thank you. I appreciate that. There we go. I did it. Look, PRBR. Thank you. We are DJ's personal AI. I like it. Thank you, Melanie K. Excellent. Lou 19. Beth Barry. Wow. Great to see everyone here tonight. We will be back next week And thank you again, Carolyn, for running the ideas for me. You did a stellar job. And Kate's out there. It's great to see you. Space Ghost, thank you, sir. Much obliged. We will see you all next week. And have a fantastic weekend. And we'll keep an eye on this ever-changing Intel manipulation of the UFO file. But I hope we delivered some great information for you tonight. And, you know, it says end broadcast, but really never ends. So we'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye. See you soon.